You take the marker stones of Stonehenge, bang, hits the pyramid. Take the Christ triangle and extend it, bang, it hits Bethlehem. Some old savage really lucked out. Now, the pyramid, as we've said many times, could not be built. And I'll tell you, you give me my budget in 1987, and I will return to the pyramid and take us on into the King's Chamber. This pyramid, that is but a geometric replica of the earth, that some 2.5 millenniums prior to the common era or AD measured the distance to the sun, the shape and circumference of the globe, the elliptical orbit of the earth around the sun, and a knowledge, perceived a knowledge of the universe that we were some 15 centuries into this era before we begin to understand. Who built it and what its meaning is has been the subject of a lot of past teaching and on reruns this week. Josephus said that before the flood, the descendants of Seth, the priestly line, after the death of Abel, Seth, the next son, appointed the priest after Adam, and the priestly line's descendants revealed by God, that having it revealed to them by God that a Holocaust was coming, preserved knowledge that God had given them in two monuments. Josephus is writing in the first century. These two monuments, one of brick near the river Euphrates, the other of stone in the land of Sirius, or the land of Egypt, that was referred to as the land of Sirius because of their worship of the dog star. The one of brick and stone having been destroyed, and the one of stone, Josephus says, still standing in Egypt in his day. Now, the pyramid of Giza was never built as a burial place. And in its chambers and in its measurements, many have seen a prophetic outline of world history, particularly as it relates to the chosen people of all things, the Jew and the house of Israel. The measuring devices are known as the pyramid inch. And with modern measurement instruments, if you were to measure the distance from the North Pole to the South Pole in a hypothetical line through the center of the earth and divide it into 500 million equal parts, you would have the pyramid inch. That inch, some have said, to try to find an analogous, simple-minded comparison, varies no more than a half breadth of hair. Now, we have different thickness of hair, but it gives you some little visual concept. Take your hair, pull out one of them, split it in half. The diameter of what's left, the radius, if you will, of one of your strands of hair. That's the difference between the pyramid inch and the British inch and the American inch. Now, they still try to get us on a metric system. How come the British and their offspring, the Americans, still measured by the inch. Now that pyramid inch, which the British and American inch varies from by only a half a hair's breadth, becomes the so-called sacred cubit when pushed to a larger linear measurement unit, which is used only in the building of the pyramid, the Ark of the Covenant, and Solomon's Temple, and most likely Noah's Ark. These connections cannot be ignored. The lineup of Stonehenge with the pyramid and over to Bethlehem, the connection between the measuring unit, the pyramid inch, the British inch, the American inch, and the sacred cubit, which is a derivative thereof, you can't ignore those things. What is this strange link-up between Britain, the British Isles, and the pyramid, and the chosen people as God's oracle, the Jews and the house of Israel? People have puzzled for years over the missing years of Christ's life. After the 12-year-old incident when he was confounding the doctors in the temple, and it's too hot in here, at Jerusalem, he disappears. He shows up again when he's reached the age under Jewish law that he could enter ministry. And he subjected himself to the Jewish law. What happened to this genius that confounded the teachers in the temple between 12 and 30 years of age? Now, there are those that say he visited Tibet. There are those that say he visited South America and became the source of their expectancy of a bearded white man to come that made them give up their kingdom so readily to the Spanish conquistadores. If he was what the church says he is, and if he did come to redeem the world, is there anything that says he couldn't have covered that ground between 12 and 30? That's 18 years for the Lord of glory to be lost. Oh, here we go again. There have been so many legends and so many caricatures and so many bent-out-of-shape truths that the historic church is scared to even touch the subject. One of the Eastern churches claims to have a letter from Jesus. Those kinds of legends that cause the church world to turn off, and they won't even pursue the subject. Jesus is the first man that was 12 and then became 30 in one step. Now, he must have been gone from the little area of Palestine and Galilee where he grew up. His cousin John didn't even recognize him. I mean, we're talking about a town like Barstow would look like a big city. Palm Springs would look like New York City by comparison. He was in little villages around Galilee where you walk from village to village. You don't live there for 18 years. Particularly when you come home from Jerusalem and you confounded all the religious leaders of the time. Give me a real little bitty town out here in the... Who? Well, talk louder. Blythe. The L.A. Times and the radio carries the articles. 12-year-old genius from Blythe confounds all the professors of UCLA, USC combined. And he goes back to Blythe and makes cabinets for 18 years. And nobody ever pays any attention. He's such an entity in Blythe after that great splash of confounding the professors at UCLA and USC that when he's 30, they don't even know who he is. He's so unrecognizable that they seek, when he comes out of the shop, to impose a stranger's tax on him. A non-resident foreigner's tax. That makes sense. But of course, most of Christianity has never done anything sensible for 2,000 years. They leave their brain somewhere else. He wasn't in Palestine. Now, you can expect the great imitator and the great caricature who knows where Jesus went to try to come up with enough faker stories to, again, as with the British Isles problem of the lost tribes, to make the responsible church historian avoid the subject like a plague for fear that he will be thought a nut. We need some churchmen willing to be king of hearts. Join the nuts for a while for a purpose. To you that have seen that movie. These are subjects too long given over to the nuts and neglected by the historic church of responsible scholarship. And God's not the author of fear. Where was Jesus between the ages of 12 and 30? And instead of abandoning the pursuit of an answer because so many far-fetched tales are told, sort the tales out. Reading from a book by E. Raymond Capt, The Traditions of Glastonbury. One day a small boat. Now a lot of you have copies of this book. Just remember how you felt when you first heard it and stay with me. And as usual, you'll learn something new. How many of you here got copies of this book? How many of you can recite it? That ought to shut you up. One day, a small boat from one of the large merchant ships anchored in the Bristol Channel tied up at the causeway of the Lake Village. A bearded man and a slim young boy in his early teens stepped ashore. Now, I happen to believe what Paul said. The wrath of God against ungodliness has been revealed from the heavens. Now, most people who read that opening chapter of the book of Romans are so glad to find brickbats to throw at homosexuals that they miss the profoundness of the opening remarks. It's not talking about the wrath of God yet to come. It's talking about a revelation already given for which all mankind is responsible. And the plea of ignorance will not stand because God revealed His plan of the ages from the heavens first. And that plan of God set in the movements of the stars and the gallery of the heavens to be read by all before they could read and write, if necessary, was distorted into imagery, and the creature began to be worshipped in idolatry instead of the Creator. The church is long needed to restore the message of the stars that God gave from the beginning to the knowledge of the Christian, which is one of the reasons why I want to get going on Secret 4. We've taught God's message in the stars. Now that message in the stars, which has been there forever in spite of being distorted, and once more because of the distortions, the historic church has avoided wrestling with that message that has been there in the heavens from the beginning. God wrote a message for the scientific age, which now is upon us. His Bible in stone in the pyramid. And just because some anti-cult figures are too stupid or lazy to ferret out the truth from the error doesn't mean the church world should avoid it, because once again, Satan, knowing the truth of that message, moved in and took it over. As he has with the Babylonian substitutes, moved into the church and distorted most of the truths once delivered unto the saints. These are truths that ought not to be neglected by the church, because they show God's hand of control on all history and all creation, and seen aright will enhance, enliven, and bring forth the worship of the great Creator. Now, once again, because of this truth, the best proved up available record of what Christ was doing, at least a part of those 18 years, has been clouded by all the multiplied legends. Don't throw the baby out of the bathwater. One day, a small boat from one of the large merchant ships anchored in the Bristol Channel, tied up at the causeway of the Lake Village. A bearded man, by the way. You will also find a replica in the geography of the area around Glastonbury of that great procession of figures in the sky, which is God's message in the sky. Took modern airplanes to be able to see that here you have laid out in the geography around Glastonbury the same pattern of that heavenly record of the procession from Virgo to Leo the Lion, laid out in the geography around Glastonbury. There is a strange fascination that God has had with the British Isles, with Egypt, and with Palestine. The Bible prophesies that in the last days, Egypt will return to God. One of the neglected areas of happenings that will occur during the tribulation is the reason why Egypt, the king of the south, continues to fight against Antichrist, who comes out of the area of the old Seleucid kingdom, the king of the north. It's not just territorial aggrandizement that makes the king of the south oppose the king of the north. Egypt is going to play a role of fighting against Antichrist in the last days. Maybe because that fighting against Antichrist is part of the same record of prophetic fulfillment, where they return to a knowledge of God and see the real evil of Antichrist, which the Jews themselves do not see in their covenant of peace with him at the outset. God is in control, is the message that I preach. I preach for one reason: to develop and bring forth a faith in God, because Paul says faith cometh by hearing, hearing by the Word of God. That includes His Word in the stars, His Word in the stone, His Word in the book. Some strange fascination God had with the British Isles. A bearded man and a slim young boy in his early teens stepped ashore. They were no strangers to the villagers who crowded around to welcome them. The merchant had been coming by their village for many years, on his way to the lead mines of the Mendip Hills. It was known that he held a very important position in the powerful Roman government and carried the title Nobilis Decurio. It was rumored that he owned many of the merchant ships that came to these isles of the West from Rome and Phoenicia to barter for metal and other goods. The auburn-haired lad was also known. He had accompanied his uncle on a prior visit, staying at the village and exploring the surrounding territory, while his uncle conducted his business at the nearby Mendip lead mines. But this time, a woman, perhaps in her early 30s, was with him. As the boy helped the woman ashore, the crew proceeded to unload various sized chests and sacks, obviously belonging to them. Accommodations were soon found. The baggage was carried to one of the tiny huts facing the estuary. In the weeks that followed, the merchant and the boy constructed a wattle hut, similar to those of the village on a nearby island. The site they chose was at the base of a hill from which ran a spring of fresh water. Hawthorn and oak trees dotted the landscape. Small game and fish were in abundance, and the marshy, fertile shores promised bountiful crops. When the hut was finished, the woman and the boy moved from the village to their new home. The merchant and his men sailed away. Jesus and his mother, Mary, were alone. Fiction? Well, maybe. But there is an awful lot of evidence that the reason that Joseph of Arimathea was able to get Jesus down from the cross have instant access to Pilate in that confused week, be above the ability of the Sanhedrin and the Pharisees to get at him, was that he had two roles. He was a member of the council, powerful among the Jews, and at the same time as Jerome, who produced the Vulgate translation, called him Nobilis Decurio, an officer of Pilate, first things first here, folks. Got to keep my brain warm. Minister of Mines. Awful lot of evidence suggests that Joseph of Arimathea was a wealthy Jew, member of the Sanhedrin, who plied a string of merchant ships between the coast of Palestine, stopping off at Marseille in Spain, hiring Phoenicians to haul from the tin mines and the lead mines around Cornwall and Glastonbury. The legends have it that this merchant group, the Phoenicians, before they would reveal the secret source of their tin mines, would scuttle a ship. And those Phoenician merchants insured one another, feeling that it was worth all the other merchants coming up with the ante to replace a scuttle ship rather than reveal the secret source of the lead and the tin and the minerals that they were ferrying into the Mideast area to provide the raw material for the war machine that was crisscrossing that land in constant warfare from Egypt to Syria. Joseph of Arimathea, wealthy Jew, minister of mines, had a great merchant fleet and frequently made the trip to Britain and back. The tin miners in Cornwall to this day still sing the song, "Joseph was a tin miner." He knew the route. He had the contacts. In addition, he was the uncle of Jesus. The reason that Joseph and Mary could be traveling back to their home and not aware of the missing 12-year-old boy is because he was often the ward of his uncle, great uncle Joseph of Arimathea. He was a relative of Christ, which gave him the authority to ask him, his body, to be taken down from the cross. It was that power of position that made him an early protector of the Christians in the first years after Christ's death, resurrection, and ascension. His power with both Rome and his position on the Sanhedrin made him a powerful protector of the Christians. And there are some people that are forever saying that Christianity should always stay in the slums and always stay with the outcast and the poor and the powerless. The church has always relied by God's wisdom on properly placed people that could use their influence as God's instrument for His purposes. Daniel, Esther, Moses floated into the Pharaoh palace that he might become the leader of the people. Joseph of Arimathea, Paul, who had been taught at the feet of Gamaliel, who in Romans 16 and 2 Timothy 4 indicates that the Roman senator Pudens has the same mother as he has. So here is Paul's mother and either his half-brother or full-brother, a Roman senator. And the Silurian household in its power is so influential that that church in Rome, the daughter of the Silurian king Caradoc, as we'll come to later and have taught in the past, became the adopted daughter of the Roman Emperor Claudius and changed her name to Claudia. And she is the Claudia we encounter in Scripture. God has always used these powerfully placed people.
This is the end of Side 3. For the rest of the teaching, please turn the tape over for Side 4.